Best-selling writer Jane Heller thought she'd found her dream man until he turned out to be a frequent flyer, the term doctors and nurses use to refer to patients who land in the ER regularly. In her new book, You'd Better Not Die or I'll Kill You, Jane shares her experiences of looking after her chronically ill husband with wit and offers practical guidance for handling it all without drowning. With advice on staying healthy while caring for a loved one and learning to communicate with medical staff, plus wisdom from other caregivers and experts. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jane Heller to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Joe.
Subtitle of the book, A Caregiver's Survival Guide to Keeping You in Good Health and Good Spirits. Why is that such a tall order?
You know, when you go on an airplane, the flight attendant will always say if the oxygen mask drops down, you are supposed to put it on yourself first and then put it on a young child. And the same sort of holds true for caregivers. If we go down, who's going to take care of the person that we love, whether it's a child or a spouse or an elderly relative? So many statistics cite how caregivers actually die before the person they're supposed to be taking care of because of the stress, because of, you know, the neglect of, I mean, I was guilty. I said, who needs to go to the doctor? I've got a priority, and that's my husband. So, you know, we tend to neglect our health. We tend not to exercise. We tend to eat badly, if at all, you know, all of those things. So I thought, well, I'm gonna write a survival guide so that we can navigate all this better.
In writing a survival guide, and it is a matter of survival. I think just coming out of this, having been a caregiver with my brother for 4 years for my dad who passed away in June, and it is an incredible thing. And I don't think until his passing did I realize the magnitude of the job that we undertook for so long.
It is a job, and it's an unpaid job, and there are 65 million caregivers in the U.S. alone, and that's only going to grow as they talk about the silver tsunami as, you know, our population ages. So many of us are stretched and pulled in all directions, and as you know now firsthand, it takes a toll. It takes a toll physically and emotionally, and it's difficult, but I really tried to make my book, my novels are romantic comedies, so I've always approached everything with humor, and I think it's so important to find, even in the grimmest times, even if it's black humor, gallows humor, whatever works for you, you've got to find something, you know, joyous to connect with in order to stay sane.
Other than, I mean, obviously the words responsibility and love are partial answers to this, but how do caregivers find themselves in that role?
Well, for many people, I mean, life is so unpredictable. We know this. It sounds very bleak, but we could go outside and be hit by a bus. I mean, we don't know what will happen to us. So we really do have to live for the moment and appreciate the moment. But that said, you know, we aren't prepared. I certainly wasn't prepared, even though, as you probably saw from the material or the book, that my mother was a caregiver to two sick husbands.
Right.
And I thought, that's it. You know, there's too much dropping dead of men around my household. I want a guy who's going to stick around. So, you know, some people marry for money. I married for health. Only, joke was on me, my husband had something called Crohn's disease, which I didn't know anything about. So there I was walking down the aisle, repeating the in sickness and in health part of the marriage vow. Really not paying much attention, and I think many of us don't. We just sort of walk through it with, you know, passion and hope and everything else. And then all of a sudden you realize life is here. And life means trips to the emergency room and surgery and, you know, sorting out what medications somebody is on, all of that. And we aren't prepared. So, you know, they always say that raising kids, you wish you had a manual. Well, I thought maybe we needed a manual.
In the manual, you talk about in 1 year in 2010, your husband had two surgeries. And so you find, oh, okay, there's the first one, and okay, then there's the second one. And it's not like anything is planned. It just sort of all erupts and goes
right
from one thing to another. And it never really seems to have a defined, you know, they call it the journey, but you never know where you're going. there's no map.
You're so right. And not only that, if you're dealing with somebody who's got a disability or a chronic illness as opposed to a critical illness, which sadly has a beginning and a middle and an end, I interviewed somebody in the book who's the mother of a son on the autism spectrum. And she was saying there is no beginning, middle, and end. It's a chronic, lifelong situation where you're going to have stretches that are better than other stretches. So in 2010, my husband Michael was in the hospital four times with two surgeries because, you know, there were complications and you deal with those. But what that does is, for the caregiver, it puts you on high alert. You know, your adrenaline is pumping 24/7 because you're always on alert for something to go wrong. And that's when you really have to watch yourself and say, okay, I will react when it's appropriate and only then, but not be on guard every minute of every day.
In just the final year of my father's life, he was hospitalized 17 times, and plus two fairly lengthy stays in rehabilitation. And so much so that the nursing staff at the hospital, you know, not only did they get to know you, but I don't think they ever really thought we left when we came back. And and at a point, you'd think you'd get better at it. But what I found is that you always sort of started the process new, as if it was a bad vacation and you only remembered the good parts.
That's interesting. Well, I'm sure for you, every hospitalization, every setback was a sort of a new scenario that had its own set of problems.
Right.
Because that's certainly been my experience. Each trip to the hospital, each complication, you know, had its own little sort of story arc and its own set of characters. And you really have to take each one. It's not a whole meal, so to speak. It's pieces and bites, and you have to just put one foot in front of you and take each one as it comes. Otherwise, you will be overwhelmed, and I'm sure you were on many occasions.
The thing I love about the book is that you talk about some very real issues, things as simple as how do you deal with your siblings, who may live far away and you're trying to communicate with them, and how to deal with that nurse at the front desk who just won't give you the information that you need, even though you had a breakthrough last night and you found out a bunch of information, but how do you find out more?
or from a different nurse. I mean,
or from a different nurse. And you talk about this too. I mean, I basically, you know, putting your team together and playing everybody against each other just so you can find out what's going on.
Well, I interviewed an ER doc in the book, and she said to me, do you know what the worst day to be in the hospital is? And I just threw out Christmas Day, figuring that, you know, everybody's away. And she said, no, that's the second worst day. The first worst day is July 1st. The whole month of July, actually, because that is when all the doctors and nurses sort of get promoted. So the interns become residents, or the residents become attendings, or whatever the chain is. And so everybody's in a new job. And if you can picture that, you know, it's sort of random chaos. And then particularly when there are shift changes, so 7 in the morning or 7 in the evening, that's when mistakes happen the most, and that's when you, as the advocate, the caregiver, have to be particularly, you know, juggling and saying, okay, he was on this, why isn't he still on this, and really being, again, on alert. So they're just sort of things that you need to know if you're going to be spending any time at all at the hospital or at a, you know, rehab facility, whatever it may be.
How many times did you find yourself, my brother and I went through this with our spouses, so many times where we would look at each other and one of us would be with my dad at any given time. And we had a team of other people who would come in, but for the most part, one of us would be there at any given time. And when he was hospitalized or when he was in a rehabilitation center, and you would have to go through, and this is nothing against the system, as it were, but you would have to fight for them and say, all right, well, when is this test going to happen? And you said this was going to happen yesterday, and it hasn't happened yet. So when does that happen? And when do we get out of here? And all of those questions that, of course, my dad was asking me and my brother, and I'm sure your husband was asking you, you know, when is this going to end? And when are we going to be able to go home? And you think to yourself, if I weren't here, what would happen? And then you look around at other patients who didn't have anybody there, who didn't have that team, who didn't have that advocacy. And you wonder, good Lord, how does that work?
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, it doesn't work as well, for sure. But we, as the advocates, don't really make anything happen faster. I mean, that may be just a little bit of magical thinking on our part, because what you just described, I almost started laughing because it's so typical of everybody has that same thing where they tell you a test is going to be, you know, at 3 o'clock
right.
That afternoon. It's never at 3 o'clock,
no.
Ever. And they tell you you're going to be discharged at noon. It's never at noon. Their timetable is just, you know, something from fantasy land. Because they're all about triage. And it's helpful to learn their triage system, what takes priority in a hospital. And it's going to be the patient that's just come in on an ambulance, you know, who's in cardiac arrest or, you know, really top-tiered serious. And then it goes down from there, and there is gridlock. There is just gridlock. And we have, that is one of the places where we can take, you know, breaths, and we can say, okay, this isn't going to happen within the hour. It really isn't. So how can we occupy the time in the meantime? It's just something that we have to accept, because we can go up to the desk 100 times and say, well, you said that he's going home. It's just, it doesn't matter what we think.
You really think that? I have to, I mean, I question, I don't disagree with you, but I do wonder, because there the old saying, of course, is that the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And I do feel sometimes that if you are there and you are omnipresent, and there is a presence there, and they know the crew that is on call at that time has to answer to you, and that you can literally collar someone in the hall, that you have a better chance of getting your question answered or your need taken care of than if no one is there.
You absolutely do, and I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. I mean, you know, the timetable of how slowly things move, it's going to be the same. But
yeah.
You are absolutely right. If staff knows that there is a family member, you know, watching, and you can be there and ask questions. I mean, one of the problems that I had really talk about in the book is how to get a doctor to answer your questions. I found that so many of them do these, what I call hit and runs. You know, they come in, they say, hi, how are you? Looks great. Got to go.
Right.
And they're out the door. And I could never get off a single question.
Shut the door.
And I had a lot of them. So, you know, best to come in with your questions beforehand, either written down or on your cell phone or however you
right.
do it. And not too many, you know, no more than three or four. Or if they really are in a hurry, you say, okay, I know you can't talk to me now. When would be a good time? The family would like to have a consultation with you
yeah.
when it's convenient. And they will set up a meeting with you. And then I did something called Box the Doc, which is that I literally planted my feet in the doorway of
Absolutely.
The room. When the doctor came in, and I trapped him in the room. He couldn't get out.
Well, we used to set my wife would stay at the door. My brother and I'd be on the right-hand side of the bed. My brother would be on the left-hand side of the bed. And then my wife would take the position and my brother's wife right by the door. And then as they started to move, you would just move with them.
That's right.
Now, I don't know how you feel. My personal feeling is, with all of that said, and I hate to paint any medical institution in a bad light, but God knows they're doing incredible work. They have a million patients that they're dealing with. They have a million problems that they're dealing with.
Right.
And if I had to grade them at the end of the day, I would still give them an A because they were incredible. They do things that I can't even imagine. But obviously you want the best for your loved one.
You know, I've been on both sides too, Joe. I've been a hospital volunteer.
Right.
So I've, you know, my job was to be a quote-unquote patient visitor. So I would just walk into a room and I would talk to patients or family members about whatever their concerns were. And they would rail against, you know, why aren't I getting a blanket? Why? Where's my dinner? Where's my medicine? All of that. And I would go out to the nurse's station and say, what's up with room 103? And sometimes things fall in the middle. You know, sometimes they don't know the patient's cold because the patients never tell them, you know. There are communication gaps, and because they're microcosms of real life. Look, you know, this is how we deal in our regular life. We have sometimes trouble getting heard. All of them say to me, the best thing to do is to bring your concerns calmly to whoever is in charge. If you're not getting satisfaction from a nurse, per se, go up the chain of command. The nurse has there's a charge nurse on duty. After that, there's a supervising nurse, and so on. You really do have, outlets to tap into if there's a problem.
In the end, as I said, the subtitle of the book is A Caregiver's Survival Guide to Keeping You in Good Health
That's
and Good
right.
Spirits. And so just to end on that note, because with all that we've just described, it seems like it's far from keeping you in good health and good spirits. But success helps, keeping a good outlook and finding the humor helps, and ultimately being with the person that you're caring for helps.
Right. But I'm just cautioning to say that I did talk to one woman who said, well, I'm not going to be happy and I'm not going to take care of myself until I know that my loved one is taken care of. And the problem with that is if you wait until that other person is fixed, quote unquote, you may be missing out on moments of calm and joy for yourself. And that's not a good thing. We have to live our lives even as we're throwing ourselves into this caregiving adventure. So that's what I advocate, a balance of really putting out fires and doing the best we can for our loved ones at the same time as preserving our own health and sanity.
Well, and not to end on a sour note, but we inherited the job of caregiving from my father after my mother passed, of 3 years of caregiving for my dad. And the phone call that I had with her the night before she had her stroke that led to her death 2 weeks later was I've started the conversation by saying 39, and I said, what? And she said, I've been upstairs taking care of your father up and down the stairs 39 times today, and I don't know that I can do it again. And the next morning...
She didn't know if she could do it 40 times.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the wake-up call.
That is. That absolutely is. And so you've lived it on many levels, and you've seen it, and it isn't easy. It is not easy, and that's why your mother's a great example. She did the best she could, but there is just this point at which you say, I need help. I can't do this myself anymore.
It is, I see a lot of different books that come through on the subject, and I'm delighted to talk to you because this is really a very helpful guide, and having it be so fresh and reading it, I found myself nodding a lot and agreeing with you on many, if not most, issues. The name of the book is You'd Better Not Die or I'll Kill You, which is a great title. It's a caregiver's survival guide to keeping you in good health and good spirits. It's published by Chronicle Books. Jane Heller, congratulations on the great work you're doing, and I thank you very much for being with us.
Great to talk to you.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, You'd Better Not Die or I'll Kill You. Jane Heller is the author. The book is published by Chronicle. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.